Hey, this is Walt, and we're coming to you today from the Banff Podcast, where we are talking about all things sinister, evil, and maniacal. We are talking supervillains today, and to do that, we have a copious amount of evil, or people who claim they know evil. Today, we're going to be talking to A.P. Klosky, who has the amazingly gritty Cold Steel Wardens. How are you, sir?
Doing well. Yourself?
I'm trying to stay out of trouble, but it's tough in this haircut.
It's going to be tough with this rogues gallery, so to speak.
Yeah, and also assisting us in the evil, we have Mr. Jacob Blackman, who is doing the Legends line from Rogue Genius Games. How are you, sir?
Because it's about standards.
That was perfect. We are joined by frequent co-hosts, the Doctor of Comics, Mr. Jason Tondreau. How are you, sir?
I just want to note for everybody listening that Jacob did not rehearse that evil laugh for us before the podcast began. I believe he does have evil laugh on call.
I do, in fact.
I've had a good week because it's been spring break, so I have to go back to class tomorrow. That sucks, but it's pretty good.
Nice. And rounding us out and keeping us across many time zones, we have Mr. H. Smith. How are you, sir?
I'm pretty good, thank you. All good.
Sorry about the wacky American time convention there.
Oh, no, tell me about it. It just gets more confusing every time.
We're not happy about it here either.
So we discussed previously to the podcast that as a group, when we all launch our evil empire, the first thing we do is abolish daylight savings time. So today we are talking all things evil and sinister. Now, we had a supervillain roundtable discussion before on who is our favorite supervillains and really what makes a supervillain tick. I was wondering, because, you watch a movie or you watch like a TV show like Jessica Jones, and at the end of the movies, 99% of the time, the director only has one shot at, bringing that comic book universe to the cinema. A lot of times the villains die. So in comics, which is a serial medium and can go on for years, decades, how do you keep a villain fresh? I mean, if you got the big bad who is constantly showing up, Dr. Doom, Darkseid, guys who just are constantly in the spotlight, the Joker. How do you constantly keep those fresh across multiple writers and across multiple, sometimes, titles?
That's a good question. Who wants to go first? Jacob?
Well, I can understand the fact that intellectual properties are a thing, but there are times where I do have a problem with it, especially in the case of characters like the Joker. This guy is so bad in the fact that he is so much of a psychotic and so much of a murderer. He's just known for it. If people actually see a character like the Joker and they're like, I'm going to die. And if they don't, they go home and have a long cry because, oh my God, I lived. But my friends and I often think about how characters like that maintain freshness, and often I find some of the writing to be a little sloppy in that, the Joker kills a whole bunch of people this time, and next time it's even worse. You need to find new ways to keep the character interesting. And honestly, for me, I think the addition of Harley Quinn made the Joker new, fun, and interesting when that happened, because it gave him a new angle in a relationship and how he interacts with people, as opposed to just his thugs, just the people he hires.
Joker might be a great test case for this whole problem, because he's been through so many different phases over the years. There was the kind of man who laughs phase when he was first created back in 39, and then by the 60s, he's in that he's more like the Batman 69 kind of
66.
I was half wrong. Batman, he's that kind of art, crime as art motif.
Let's have a surf battle.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, King of the Beach. Yeah, the King of the Beach episode.
Yeah.
Or and that followed through into the early 80s films where, again, he's performing crime as art. But then it's competing with the Frank Miller kind of Joker as psycho mass murderer who was that great line from Dark Knight Returns. Like, I don't count, but all of you do, and I bless you for it. I love you for it, right? And finally we get to something like Morrison's take on the character, which is not to pick one of those versions as true, but to say all of those versions were true. That the Joker has actually been both the guy that murdered everybody at the Letterman show, the David Letterman show, and the guy who fought Batman to be King of the Beach. And somehow the impossibility of that is something that Morrison tries to embrace. And then after Morrison, we get the Joker that cuts his own face off, right?
Well, that's the thing. Has he cut his own face off?
Yeah.
Because they've only used him twice since the New 52 launched, and that was the first appearance with that. And then there was kind of some vaguery if that was actually the Joker at all, and it might have been somebody.
Well, of course they retconned it, right?
But I mean, yeah, exactly.
At the time that it was written, it was the Joker cutting his face off.
I mean, at the moment, technically speaking, the Joker's cured as it stands exactly at this point in time. He's actually not the Joker anymore. The Lazarus pit or whatever the thing that was in his spine cured him and Batman from being insane.
And they can just reboot the universe as often as they want and pick which stories are canon and which ones aren't. I guess all I was trying to get at was that maybe there has been no villain who has been retconned and refashioned as often as the Joker.
I have to agree with that assessment.
See,
yeah.
I find that I definitely agree, but I find that you've missed what to me might be the most seminal change in there, in that Batman or that Joker transition, and that's the kind of move between your Batman 66 and your Frank Miller 1983, and that's the Denny O'Neill run through there, where you really start seeing some layers of complexity being added to the Batman Batman Joker dynamic, I think, that ends up culminating in, you know, the death of Jason Todd.
Yes,
I think that segment there really shows a lot of evolution, and that's I think how we end up with Grant Morrison taking on Arkham Asylum and being able to say, look, let me play multiple choice with my past.
Yeah, well, that's Killing Joke, right?
I think really Denny O'Neill kind of. Yeah, that's true. But you get that same riff in 89 with Arkham Asylum, where, you know, he believes he's possessed by one of the Voodoo Loa one day, and then the next day he's just crazy, and then the next day it's super sanity.
Yeah.
So I think it's that transition from Batman 66 into the Denny O'Neill on the editorial there, and then into the Alan Moore and the Frank Miller that we start seeing that.
You know, well, to try to get back to your question, like, how do you keep these villains fresh? I think that what we're talking about here is, for one thing, embrace multiple creative talents. In other words, one of the reasons why the Joker's been able to stay fresh is because different people have brought their own interpretations to the character over the decades. And while not everybody likes every version, it's always different. It's never the same version. And so, you know, Heath Ledger's Joker was definitive for like 10 years. And and I guess now we're going to see if Leto can compete with that. So totally, first, embrace multiple points of view on the character. And secondly, I think a lot of these characters are responding to social movements in their own history. You know, like Miller's Joker and Denny O'Neill's Joker and Heath Ledger's Joker, you could argue are very much products of the 80s, the 70s, and the 2000s, respectively. And the way that they dress and the way that they talk and the way And sometimes this can be bad because the characters age and they date, and you look back at at the Batman 66 and it looks dated to us. And to some people, that's a terrible turnoff, but to others, it's wonderful nostalgia. So history is not always a cure-all, but it makes sure that the character is fresh because the character seems relevant to its time. Now, that also means that he gets a shelf life, you know, where he may not be relevant 10 years later. But at the time, and for most of us, we're talking about gaming, you only got to worry about, you know, the 6 months that your game lasts, or if you're lucky, a year and a half. I mean, these days, getting a game to last over a long time is kind of a miraculous alignment of the planets, you know?
Unlike the recent Strikeforce Kickstarter, yeah, where that game lasted for decades.
And that is exactly what I was thinking of when you were talking about this, because there's a whole section in Strikeforce, the original Strikeforce, about the villain of Overlord, the primary villain of that game, and how Alston tried to keep that character interesting and relevant over the years, so that eventually he sort of has a conversion moment where he realizes that his villainy has been a product of his own psychological limitations, and he gives up all of that stuff, and he kind of becomes an ally of the PCs instead of the ultimate villain. And it was a major turning point in the game. But it's even the best GMs grapple with this question, and I suspect I want to point to it more than once, but if any of you are ever uncertain about how to run a good superhero game, you know, get Strikeforce, because there's almost no problems of an ongoing superhero game that Alston didn't wrestle with. Your answers may not always be the same as his. You might have different players, or you have different things you want to emphasize, but somebody smarter than all of us answered all these questions once, right?
And that's if you can find the original copy. Now, yeah. I was lucky enough to where, as a very kind gift from Andrew Colas, he actually found an original copy under in plastic wrap. It still had the shrink wrap on it.
Oh wow!
So yeah, you know, but I mean, you know, to the benefit of the Kickstarter is that you're gonna get another edition coming out, and like you were talking about that dated feel, yeah, you're gonna see very little of that because now it's been updated to modern times. So I mean, that's pretty interesting.
So speaking of Kickstarter, I'm going to segue.
That's, you know, your blunt force segue is noted. Continue.
Genius.
You did it first. AP, tell us about your thing.
Sure. Going up, actually, tomorrow is the second book in the Cold Steel Wardens line, Cold Steel Wardens Rogues Gallery, which is very fitting, us talking about villains here, because it's chock full of them and the lovely places they inhabit, like Stonegate Federal Penitentiary and Lindcroft Asylum, and a whole bevy of mooks, madmen, masterminds, and metahumans to throw down in New Court. So about that.
I have kind of an interest in supervillain prisons. I wrote a supervillain prison for M&M's second edition. Can you tell us about yours?
Well, it was kind of interesting because with Rogues Gallery, I definitely wanted to go in almost the opposite direction as a lot of these, because I found oftentimes you have power dampening collars or cells that are built to withstand a some guy who can bench press a Buick. To me, that's great, and in the right setting, that works well. But for New Corinth, for Cold Steel Wardens, that didn't necessarily make sense. Cold Steel Wardens is very much grounded in the Iron Age, the street level, the people coming to terms with the idea of power. Definitely more your Daredevil, your Jessica Jones than your Avengers.
Yeah.
So, given that, one of the big things that I wanted to explore with Stonegate, particularly, is what would a modern-day prison look like if they have people who could, you know, grab the bars and just melt them, or, you know, bust through the wall? How is a prison warden, in this case, Warden Grace Tancredi, supposed to deal with this problem as it's emerging? To me, that provides a driving conflict that can, for a GM, make an entire campaign.
Yeah.
What do you do with a problem like Stonegate?
Yeah, I would love to play a prison-based campaign. I think it's a great setting. And it sounds like if the characters still have their powers,
in fact,
Yeah, very much so.
In fact, that's one of the major issues. Within the lore of New Corinth, there's been legislation made that you cannot be discriminated against on the basis of being what's referred to as a living weapon, that you cannot have your civil rights curtailed simply because you are a human or have access to some certain thing. And because of that, these people are being treated equally. You can't put them just in solitary confinement. You can't bury them. You have to deal with the fact that this is a person who could shoot, you know, shoot lightning bolts at you, but at the same time, you have to, as a prison warden or a prison guard, attempt to maintain discipline.
Yeah.
Lucky for you, there's a I put a pretty lengthy section in there about how to use this sort of prison in a setting. So if you wanted to build a campaign based on, you know, John Ostrander's Suicide Squad,
yeah,
I mean, that provides a great impetus, you know, as a GM, you know, sitting on the outside. If you want to, you know, have your, if you want to deal with something like the prison riot scene in Watchmen, well, what would that look like in this sort of thing? So, so there's quite a few pages about how to adapt that sort of idea into a Cold Steel Warden game.
So I have to confess, I have not played your game, and I'm very interested in superhero games. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about what the design intention is for Cold Steel Wardens. Like, I get that it's an Iron Age game, but how is that reflected in the mechanics of the game?
Can I just interrupt for 1 second? I just have to say, you have one of the best named sections in any RPG book I've ever read.
Which one?
It's called Taking a Dirt Nap. Just had to throw that in there.
Yeah. Yep. Unless I'm wrong, that's in the injuries and psychosis section. I would have to double check. But it's Cold Steel Wardens apart is what I'm guessing you're asking here.
Mechanically. Yeah.
For me, this takes a little bit of a history lesson because right before I started writing Cold Steel Wardens, I wanted to, you know, the Watchmen movie had just come out.
Oh.
I wanted to run a Watchmen-themed game.
Yeah.
You know, and I could not find anything that wanted to fit the bill. Champions didn't work for me. Mutants and Masterminds I was on and off with.
Yeah.
A couple other systems just didn't fit the bill. I ended up settling on Heroes Unlimited with a grafted-on Call of Cthulhu sanity system, and it was a hot mess. But not long after that, Icons comes out.
Yeah.
Steve Kenson, love Icons. Great, you know, real light, Silver Age style game. Fantastic. So that summer, I sit down and say, well, why not me? You know, so I sit down, I start writing. Eventually, that becomes Cold Steel Wardens.
So Steve, now, if Steve Kenson is listening, it's all your fault.
It is absolutely his fault.
Well, if a guy makes a superhero game to compete with his own superhero game,
yeah,
I guess we can all do it, right?
Well, so mechanically speaking, I, you know, was sitting down. Okay, how do I? What are the hallmarks of a good, well-written Iron Age comic? Now, I mean, the Iron Age gets a lot of shade thrown at it for Rob Liefeld-esque art and you know, crappy allusions to sex and violence and. To a degree, those have some importance. We're dealing with more mature themes, but for every bad, you know, foil covered Ghost Rider that there is,
are you looking at my collection again?
Are you kidding? I have like four of them sitting in my game room right now.
Nice. All right, go on.
But for every bad example of those extreme tropes, you're also getting pieces of art like Neil Gaiman's Sandman. You're getting Grant Morrison's Arkham Asylum. You're getting Alan Moore and Frank Miller and, you know, some of the greatest luminaries of comics writing.
Yeah.
So how do I approach that in terms of a game? Well, the core to me is providing the unanswerable questions that we're all trying to answer.
Okay.
You know, what is right? What is justice? What does it mean to put on a mask and go out and fight crime? What good are you really doing?
Yeah.
You know, is this worth the stress? And what toll is that going to take on the individual? You know,
last podcast I brought up Vigilante.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody had read it, but I'll bet you know it. I bet you know the book I'm talking about, right? Where where he shoots himself at the end of a 50-issue run because he just can't handle the guilt anymore.
Vigilante was one of those seminal comics from back in the day. That was an amazing story. But
it's heavy. It's meaty. I mean,
although the costume always caught me as a little weird.
It is a little weird, yeah.
But to me, that sort of philosophical and ethical conflict is at the core of the Iron Age. So I wanted a game that in addition to swinging from rooftops and, you know, taking down thugs in a back alley, is going to address that. So things that feature very heavily in Cold Steel Wardens mechanically are things like flaws, things like psychoses. Mental strain is just as important as physical strain in this, and it's harder to recover from. Coupled with that, you have the heroes who have different stances, and stances in Cold Steel Wardens reflect directly into what we call the vigilance pool, which is kind of a shared dice pool that the group can use to take narrative control from the GM and to reroll dice and et cetera. Yeah. But the way that you refresh that pool, the way that you allow yourselves that benefit mechanically out of character is by in character coming into conflict with each other. When Aunt May gets strapped to the train tracks and causes you a problem that you have to deal with, more dice go in the pool.
It's not just rescuing your own dependent NPC. It's conflict between player characters.
Yeah. When we have two vigilantes who don't necessarily agree on what they should do with the crime boss they just kidnapped.
Yeah.
You know, when we have that conflict, dice go in the pool. So
it's a Daredevil Punisher conflict kind of driven game.
Exactly. And next man, end of this week, can't wait for that.
Yeah. Now, I remember those issues where they would tell the same story from each character's point of view. Do you remember that?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, what a great hook. Yeah.
But within the context of the game, it gives the players the incentive to disagree and to bring in that inner character drama.
Yeah, it's a great game for players and GMs who like inside the party conflict.
Absolutely. And in fact, Within the set of pregens that I go to run with at conventions, that there are a number of characters who just do not see eye to eye on certain things. I had one that I was using it was kind of a pastiche off of Merle from The Walking Dead. We called him Mr. Mallet.
Okay.
And Mr. Mallet is, for lack of a better term, a racist, misogynist ass.
Right.
But he's brutally effective, and he's a phenomenal guy to have your back in combat. But is this the guy you're really going to hang out with? Is this guy really a hero? Well, he calls himself one.
Yeah.
I have to say that reading Cold Steel Wardens, I was kind of giddy when I came on a couple of things. Like, you have the room that the Joker obviously stayed in on 139. With all the writing on it, like the fevered writing that you would see in like some horror movies.
Yep.
And then, in the section on addictions and stuff, you actually have a pretty chilling image of, which reminded me of when we had a discussion, and Jason, I believe you were present for this, with Green Arrow's sidekick, who became a heroin addict.
Mm-hmm.
They have a you have that great picture of a hero, you know, struggling, trying to not put the needle in his arm. But I got to tell you, the thing that goosed me out the most was you have a picture of all the like the type of guns and swords and knives you can encounter.
Mm-hmm.
There's a picture of a Carl Gustav in there. side by side with an M2 Bravo, I was very impressed.
glad you appreciated it. And yeah, the artist that I had working on, I was very pleased with the homage to the old Green Arrow Green Lantern comic there. He, you know, was able to put a nice riff on it without, you know, it was very obvious the homage. You guys got it clearly, but
It strikes me that this inside the party conflict is really in contrast to Icons and to a lot of other superhero games, where players can take an ability in Icons that allows me to spend my determination on the behalf of my teammates, right? Like it encourages group play, and you can even have group determination pool where, you know, one player suffers and so the other player can help him. And a lot of players, they want that. They want that conflict. They want players. They would rather see heroes fighting each other than fighting the bad guy.
And, I mean, look at what we have right now in terms of movies. We have Batman versus Superman coming out in 2 weeks. We got Civil War a couple weeks after that.
Yeah. I mean, there's definitely a theme there. Yeah, absolutely.
Yep. And I feel as players, that adds another dimension to your game as well, because it's. I mean, any game master can pull out a supervillain and some mooks and throw them down, and it's a straightforward story. Where the nuance really comes is when you don't necessarily know, well, what is right here? What should we be doing? And that conflict isn't going to be the same answer, or isn't going to be answered the same way by every given player the same way. And it's in those gradations that games get interesting.
This is really kind of the hallmark of what we call a character-driven TV series. Like, you know, you've got a mystery of the week or whatever, but the monster of the week is actually irrelevant. Like, the particular crime that you're solving on NCIS this week is completely irrelevant. The reason why people are watching is that they can watch what the characters do. It's the characters that they love, you know, that whether it's the nerdy tech gal that works in the basement or the forensic surgeon or whatever. And so it's very similar, it sounds like, in your game. Like the opposition that the GM creates for you. I mean, it's important. You've got to solve the problem of the week. But it's really about the player character tension as they try to solve that problem.
Yeah. When I was in when I was an undergrad, I studied abroad in Britain, Liverpool. I was taking a class in Chaucer.
Yeah.
And the professor I had actually very sadly had a heart attack and did not return that semester.
Did it happen in the classroom?
No. I came to class and we have a new adjunct.
Because that's my goal, by the way, to die in the classroom. But go on.
Yeah. But he, one of the few things that I still remember about what he said, those few days that I did have him, he said, conflict is at the root of all literature. After all, what would King Lear be like if everyone just sat around saying, pass the cornflakes?
right. And Chaucer, I'm going to sound like a total English nerd now, but Chaucer is a great example of that, because in Canterbury Tales, nobody gets along. And every time one guy tells a story, the next guy has to tell a story that's even better and raunchier than the guy that came before him.
Yeah. And of course, you have them going back and forth over their own little character flaws and their own personal preferences. And that meta-narrative is just as important and just as interesting as the individual stories themselves, the Miller's Tale and the Parson's Tale and whatnot. Going back to games, to me that's the same thing, is that meta-narrative of can our heroes learn to get along? Can this vigilante understand what it means to put on a mask? Does this guy really know what justice is? That, to me, is just as important as, did we bring down the crime boss? Did we shut down the drug runners? Did we beat the supervillain?
And or even just, did we have fun?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Now, going into character-driven narrative and how that affects gameplay at the table, guys like Jacob and Aid are doing frequent and serial releases, Aid for Mutants and Masterminds, and then Jacob for Rogue Genius Games with his Legends line. We were just talking about how there's always this urge to kind of one-up the villain before. How do you guys, when you guys approach characters and create like serial releases, like the villain of the week, how do you fight that urge to one-up yourself and instead craft interesting characters that might not necessarily be more powerful than the one before it?
I actually don't have the one-upmanship with my line. Mostly in the Superpowered Legends, I'm just trying to produce homage to a variety of characters that aren't otherwise represented in the Mutants and Masterminds role-playing game. Mostly what I've been doing in terms of releases is trying to keep them contemporary with what movie happens to be coming out next or the TV series that's currently launching. So trying to keep that going is rather difficult at the moment, considering how many giant team movies are about to hit me.
So it's all about keeping up with the advertising that is funding your games?
Exactly. Yeah, like, because, you know, for the upcoming release of Daredevil, which happens Friday, I believe, I wanted to make sure I had some homage characters that, you know, a street vigilante, a lady ninja, and a guy who just decides to use guns to take care of all the problems. I wanted to have homages to those particular characters ready to go.
And now when you're crafting those, initially the releases are for Mutants and Masterminds, but they've been slowly also coming out for Icons, is that correct?
Yes, I've got in touch with Mike Lafferty of Fainting Goat Games, and he and Ewalt have been doing some conversions of the characters into the Icons line, and that has been wonderful. And we've been releasing them under the Iconic Legends.
Now, when you have characters that come out like this, and say, you know, going back to what AP and Jason were talking about with conflict, you know, you might have the people who see themselves as doing the right thing facing off against the heroes who say, no, you can't do it that way. How do you work that into the different styles of games, such as Mutants and Masterminds or Icons? How do you get it so that those conflicts come out?
Well, unfortunately for me, I haven't had much to do with the story elements on that yet. Mostly I'm just introducing characters right now. I do have some comic ideas in mind, but right now I'm too busy to pursue those as projects. I'm hoping that, you know, maybe with a little Kickstarter money in the future, I'll actually be able to do some comics with these characters, and I'll be able to pursue those story ideas. But for right now, I'm just getting the characters out. Just recently, the most recent character released was my, like I said, my guy who settles with everything with guns, Judgment. He's a former judge whose family is killed by criminals, and now he's deciding that superheroes aren't doing enough, so he is taking care of the problem permanently.
And is that a giant gavel in his hand?
That is a giant gavel in his hand, yes.
How about you, Aid?
He guns them down, and then he does bad things to them with the gavel.
Oh, that's it. That's brilliant. That sounds very Cold Steel Wardens. What's that, AP?
A little bit. That's right in the wheelhouse.
How about the same questions for you, Aid? How do you balance the character interactions that you might see with heroes and some of the villains you're creating for Eminem?
Well, it's tough, because I say, as you were saying about trying to one-up myself when I create villains, I actually did the opposite. The first character I created for the Rogues Gallery was the Queen of the Improverse, and then I went down to Street Level. level. So going completely the opposite direction. So, I don't know. It's tough. I just basically my thing is more than anything else. I try to think of get a one good story for that character, and then if they take and people like them, then build from there. That's the easiest way of doing it. So when I create characters, I've kind of got like one, you know, obviously a couple of plot hooks that kind of tie into that central story, and then go from there. And then if it's a good character and people want to see it and they manage to escape or something at the end of it, that adventure, then that's where you kind of pick up from there and continue onwards. But my characters tend to be very short lived, unfortunately. It's in my game. So
now if we had to take a poll from the members of the panel today, could we come up with a formula for the supervillain that when people see them, they absolutely fall in love? Like when you see at the end of the first Avengers movie, and spoilers in case anybody has not seen a 4-year-old, 5-year-old movie.
Considering how long that movie has been out, there's no spoiler warning allowed. Just blurt it out.
Thank you.
That's the statute of limitations.
Yeah. Well, I just don't want people throwing rocks at my house. when you get that throne that turns around and Thanos is there, or in the recent Daredevil series, when you see Wilson Fisk getting dressed and it's very slow and methodical and you know it's building up to something and you have those hairs standing on the back of your neck, is there a formula for a villain that your players at the table will love? Is there like some sort of mathematical genius behind crafting villains that are not only believable but relatable in some sense?
I think one of the issues that I've come across as a GM, and this is something that I still struggle with, is that when you're crafting a great villain, you have to be able to see their perspective. Old saying, all the best villains are the heroes of their own stories. Well, from a GMing perspective, unless you take great pains, I think, to be able to provide vignettes into that villain's lifestyle or their background to make them at least a little sympathetic. Wilson Fisk from the Daredevil series was, I think, a great example of this, where you see his childhood and you see, how his father acted and you see those elements of his father coming out. And then when he finally snaps, and I won't venture into spoiler territory any further than that, but when he finally snaps, it's almost cathartic. You side with that villain because you've been along with them. I think with Jessica Jones, they did that just as well with Zebediah Kilgrave. Didn't hurt that David Tennant has a natural charisma all his own, but when you provide that sympathetic edge, Tom Hiddleston as Loki, we can see he's the spoiled, bratty younger brother who just wants his name to be called once instead of Thor's. I think when we see that degree of sympathy, that's I think what a lot of readers and players really hook onto.
Yeah, one of the things that if you notice, a lot of the villains that we're talking about in cinema or television, whether it's that Thanos revealed moment, or Wilson Fisk, that episode has one of my favorite lines, which was "Get the saw." When we see Kilgrave, a lot of these moments occur when the heroes aren't around. That is, we see Thanos when he's just surrounded by his mooks, or sidekicks. We see Fisk when he's dressing alone in his apartment. These are moments which are not intuitive to be in a role-playing game at all, because you're telling the hero's stories and they're not there. And so the GM has to be willing to kind of go outside of his comfort zone a little bit. And maybe you need to write them up as like a little fiction story and send it to all of your players before the game. Or maybe you narrate it during the session. Or maybe you do an episode where all the players are playing mooks and minions, and at the end of the episode, they all meet the big boss.
That's really good.
Yeah, it works really well. I've had a lot of fun with that kind of an episode. Because if the first time the players meet the bad guy is when they're fighting the bad guy, well, there's only one way that episode ends, really. I mean, the heroes are going to defeat him, or they're going to get defeated. And if they get defeated, they're probably just going to hate it. They're just going to resent it. Rather than having that, oh, he's cool, I can't wait for the rematch. That only works if you set him up beforehand. If he's just like this guy you've just encountered and he beats you, then it's just the DM on a power trip.
I think that setup is right where the key lies, though, because if with a really great villain, it can't be a guy who's around for one session. This is someone that you're going to build up to and build up to.
Okay, so this brings me to a second point that I wanted to make, which is acknowledge going in that not every villain you make is going to be a keeper, and that you don't know which villains are going to react with the readers. When Stan and Jack created a new villain every month in 8 different comics at once, they didn't know who was going to stick. You know, who knew that, like, the first episode of the Fantastic Four has the Mole Man in it. Okay, who gives a flying fuck about the Mole Man? And it wasn't until the fourth issue or we get Dr. Doom?
Sixth, I think. Oh, I was going to say fifth.
Okay. I will retire my PhD at once. But you sort of stumble into these villains, you know, and the players will respond. Keep your ears open and your eyes open. And when this session is over and the players start saying, oh, man, yeah, you know, they start talking about it. And if it sounds like they want the villain to come back, bring him back. But if you make this master criminal and you are all set for him to be the master villain, and when the episode is over, like, everybody cannot run to the door fast enough. Think about whether or not that's trying to tell you something about your bad guy.
I think riffing off of that, part of it, you can still guide it as a GM by dropping seeds every so often.
That's a good tool.
I think about like the very start of The Dark Knight, where you have the Joker's henchmen, you know, talking about what they've heard about the Joker.
Yeah, that's right.
And that it'd be... I love that idea of, you know, having a mook session where everyone's playing one of the mooks and eventually you meet the man in charge. But being able to approach that from the player side, maybe you hear this rumor about something that's happening. Maybe you know, you find a clue, something to a crime that you didn't happen to be able, you weren't on patrol that night, or you were taking care of something else. And slowly you start piecing together the puzzles towards that mastermind, where by the end of the campaign, you as a player learn that guy's whole story. You learn, okay, how did he end up like this, and what is our climactic showdown going to really be like? Is it going to be a quiet conversation in a dark alley, or is it going to be with someone in a graveyard?
If you start placing tips and hints in the game that you're creating a mastermind, one of your players is going to know what you're doing, and he's going to want to help you. Mm-hmm. And so he's going to start treating the bad guy like a mastermind.
Mm-hmm. I'm writing one of my convention scenarios right now. I have a convention this weekend, and one of the main villains, and this guy's appearing in Rogues Gallery, actually, is Mr. Rasputin, the unkillable man. And the entire idea behind him is not that he's a physical threat. He's not. He is a weapons manufacturer. He's a weapons designer. But the threat that comes from him is the knowledge that he carries and the fact that you just can't kill him. He'll just regenerate back, and then you have the same problem that you started with. So to emphasize him as a threat, I've been spending a lot of time working in the background of this adventure or this investigation, that even the people he's selling to don't know much about him, and all they're getting is piecemeal rumor. So it falls upon the investigators, the vigilantes, to do their homework and, you know, canvass the streets and maybe break some legs, you know, to try to find some information and do their research and be the Batman in order to find out who Ra's al Ghul's, or in this case, Mr. Rasputin, really is.
Now, that seems to me to be a very appropriate use of that character. I mean, in another game, in an Icons genre game, where you never kill the bad guy anyway, the fact that you can't kill him isn't that big of a deal. But in a game of Steel Wardens, where killing the villain is an acceptable activity,
depending on how you view killing.
Then a villain that you can't kill is a much more in-genre appropriate kind of bad guy. That sounds cool.
I'm excited for it. I called the scenario Anastasia's Bane.
Right.
I think one of the issues that comic book superhero role-playing games have is the fact that despite the fact that they try to simulate a genre, it's honestly up to the game master to produce the scenes that should be there for their players to understand who the villains are. Because in the comic books, you get to see the clips of the villains doing their thing, interspersed with the heroes. Whereas in a role-playing game, often the only time the heroes and villains interact is when they're fighting each other. You never get to see the scenes of the villains being themselves.
Yeah, that's right. And I think the example of Loki is great because that's one of the ways that you can do that. If your villain is somebody that the heroes know, and maybe even a teammate or an ally, then you can play that character alongside the other players as an NPC, and they can all get to like him, and then that establishes the character so that when they go bad, it brings some weight to it.
Yeah.
I know the Star Wars West End game, Star Wars role-playing game, they used to think it was a cutaway, they used to say. Basically, the idea of, like, Vader on the Star Destroyer deck would be a cutaway. You kind of narrate that and say, okay, and then you cut to the scene with the characters and you go, okay, you know something's up there? Your characters don't know it, but you know Vader's up there. We have to start worrying now, kind of thing.
Yeah, West End, even, they would create scripts and you would hand the script out to the
players. That's right, yes.
We would all read the scene together, yeah. Yeah.
I think it's that kind of that fall, too, that helps make villains really dynamic and really personal and gets both players and viewers invested. I mean, to me, that's why Two-Face is so sympathetic.
Yeah.
Because we see him as Harvey Dent. We see him as the White Knight of Gotham, the guy who's going to clean up the city the right way. He's not going to resort to the shadows like the Batman. He's going to bring law and order as it should be. And we watch all those plans fall apart.
You know, you've got two degrees, two vectors, right? You've got a villain who falls, starts off good and becomes wicked, and then you have the rise, a character who starts off anonymous and a nobody and ends up being, you know, the big boss at the end, right? And it's all about change. It's about creating some kind of movement in the character's arc so they're not just steady. It's like, oh, another bank robbery, like, or even... You know, it's not just that it's a bank robbery. It could be, oh, another murder, another mass murder. But if it's all just the same mass murder over and over again with a change of scenery, then we're back to the beginning of the podcast. We're talking about how the Joker was it. I think Jacob, you were talking about it, right? We're like another yeah. another murder, and you're like, I don't even care anymore.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, it's in the same line we were talking about evolution of characters, like. Recently, I was going over some old X-Men issues, and when he first appears, Magneto is your stereotypical megalomaniacal, I want to rule the world villain. It's not until much later that you get his backstory, where you find out that, you know, he spent time in the Holocaust. He was at Auschwitz and all of that, and he's like, oh, that's why he hates humans.
Yeah, yeah, and of course that none of that existed when the character was made. So this is to all of you GMs out there. Like, you don't have to invent the entire villain's backstory on day one. Like, you can just throw the bad guy out there and then retcon his history And if the players like him and they love fighting him, or maybe he's got a cool mechanical thing that you like to deploy in the game, like, oh, some the way that his powers work or interact with the player character's powers just happens to be a very cool sort of combination, then go back. And it's good enough for Claremont. It is good enough for you. Like, Magneto was retconned to be a Holocaust survivor in X-Men 150. And, you know, 150 issues went by, and he was not a Jew. And suddenly he was. So you can do that, too.
So with the excuse me, I think the Joker put something in my coffee. With us closing out on the last final minutes of the show, if people want inspiration for running some of the stuff that we're all putting out here, such as Jacob's Legends line and AP's Cold Steel Wardens, why don't you give us a shot of what people can read? To kind of get in the mood. What kind of comics would you recommend while getting into the mood to play your games?
Gosh.
So many good choices. I would probably go back and pick up Batman The Long Halloween. Oh, still yeah. One of my favorites.
Great series.
Jeff Loeb and Tim Sale. Have always really enjoyed those. I mentioned it earlier, Grant Morrison's Arkham Asylum, Serious House on Serious Earth. Trying to name something that's not a Fantastic Batman comic. let me look at my shelf here. Jake, you go ahead while I look at my shelf.
All right, well, the Superpowered Legends line put up by Rogue Genius Games, that's very much inspired by my love of Marvel comics. I intersperse some homage of DC characters in there, but mostly you get a lot of Marvel comics homages. And you know, I like to promote, you know, what I was reading back when I was a huge comics reader. You know, the Walt Simonson run of Thor. You know, when he was having Fafnir and Surtur and all those characters showing up. The Dark Phoenix saga from the early 80s, the original one, none of the repeats that have happened since then. let's see, Thunderbolts. I really liked the original run of Thunderbolts when Busiek started it, honestly, before Nicieza got a hold of it. It kind of turned on me when Nicieza got a hold of it. I am a huge, huge fan of classic hero, superhero comics, and so that's what I'm trying to emulate with the Superpowered Legends. Is that classic feel, the Bronze Age before the Iron Age.
And what's next in the lineup for the Iconic Legends line? What's coming next?
What's coming next is Typhon. Typhon is a big name supervillain for the line. He is a cosmic space villain who basically fills the niche of the evil Kirby space god. He's like Darkseid or Thanos. So he's very much about wanting to either rule and or destroy the universe if he can't have it.
Nice. Go ahead.
I just saw the one that I know is standing out of me right now, and it's this is probably the thing I'm most proud to have on my shelf right now. It's the Doctor Strange Doctor Doom crossover by Mike Mignola, and I have it autographed. It's phenomenal. I picked it up on a thrift sale. Triumph and Torment, yes. It's if you want insight into a sympathetic villain,
yeah,
that's one you need to read.
I actually got to teach that book.
Oh, brilliant.
Yeah, I had a class of about 60 undergrads, and we were doing the superhero narrative, and I was able to assign that. So yeah, it's a great book. It's phenomenal. And really, really do recommend it.
Aid for you. How about if people want to get into what you're producing, what's good inspiration for them?
Oh dear. My stuff tends to be more supernaturally kind of stuff. So I kind of the Hellboy comic, which I BPRD, which I constantly read over and over and over again because it's so good. That kind of stuff is probably the stuff that's most influential to me. So I have got a street level villain coming out pretty soon, but one of my villains is also a manifestation of all children's nightmares made into like this ambling toy golem. So that's coming up. So that's something that may fit in the Hellboy comic. So that kind of thing is probably where I would go for.
Hey, did you read Justice League Dark?
I did read Justice League Dark.
What did you think of it?
I liked it at the beginning. Then it started getting bad when. Well, the artwork for it was amazing, so that's why I stuck with it for quite some time. I can't remember why he stopped buying it. I think it's when they started changing the characters out, and a lot of the characters started leaving.
Yeah.
But they did put Amethyst and Frankenstein in it after their books were cancelled. So I think I hang on a little bit longer than I was going to originally.
Right.
Yeah, Frankenstein. That's everything. Frankenstein and Age of Shade was I really loved that book and that kind of thing. But yeah, Justice League Dark wasn't too bad. Thing. It'd be interesting to see what if Del Toro's movie thing takes off in that vein, and we get the Hellblazer Swamp Thing amalgamation thing going on. But
I don't know if you've seen the Escapist had a pretty neat article about John Constantine and the evolution of the Hellblazer comic over the years. It was up on their site. It was a good read.
Cool. Okay, that's worth a look.
And Jason, with the impending Supervillains Deluxe coming out, if somebody wants to get into your stuff, what do you recommend they read?
Oh, geez. I mean, the last superhero game that I started to – I've been running a lot of non-superhero stuff lately, but I tend to pair my superhero gaming with current events. Like, it tends to be very much linked into what's going on right now in the country.
So you have a supervillain that wears a bad hair piece and another one that constantly says she's not lying?
Yeah, you're kind of not wrong, actually, Walt. Like, for example, I ran a superhero game called POTUS, which was done during the presidential election of 2008, and the players were Secret Service agents protecting the Republican nominee, which I created a fictional former superhero that was running for president. On the Republican ticket, and I ran it during the actual nomination process. So the first episode of the game was actually the Republican convention while the convention was playing on television, and then we played through the whole election, and then the final episode of the game was staged during election night, and we were watching the coverage. Whoever won the election is who won the election in the game.
That's a really neat idea.
So the next one is my sequel game, which is called SCOTUS. And the players are marshals assigned to investigate the murder of a Supreme Court justice during the presidential election campaign. So I tend to tie into current events. So look for superhero stories that do that, which are rare.
Jason, you've got to write those as adventures. Those would be fantastic adventures.
I'd love to read those notes.
Yeah, I would like to write them up for Mutants and Masterminds. I think if I have a pitch to Green Ronin, it's probably that, the POTUS SCOTUS adventures. Yeah. And the logical, the third episode in the sequel, which would be FLOTUS. So it would have to do with the First Lady. That would be my adventure sequel. But I don't know, because if I write an adventure for Mutants and Masterminds, I'm competing with Chris McLaughlin. And, like, I don't know if I have the guts. Like, that's just, like, he's, like, I can't compete with
him. Well, you don't have to write it for Green Ronin. You can always write it for third-party publishing. It's what I do.
That's true, I could.
And, there's nobody on the panel that would allow something like that. I don't know what's going on.
No, not at all.
Would ever do conversions for that for another system that might be very heavily invested in real world politics.
Yeah, that's true. You're right. It may be a good national game. You're right.
That'd be a perfect fit. It's kind of ironic that you were talking about that. I've been toying with the idea of doing some plot point style campaigns, sort of like what Savage Worlds does, but with the the Cold Steel Warden's rule set, and one of the ones that I've been toying with takes a lot from the events going on in Ferguson and Baltimore, because it's so heavy and such a big social issue.
Yeah, I am all over that shit. Like, that's when I run a modern day game, I can't not deal with current events.
Yeah.
All right. Well, duly noted. I will file this away.
Awesome.
Well, final shots. AP.
Had a blast. Lots of great villain talk here. Lots of awesome ideas. And if you guys are interested, Kickstarter for Cold Steel Warden's Rogues Gallery goes up March 15th. That is tomorrow. If you like these ideas, Stonecroft Penitentiary, Lincroft Asylum, and a whole bevy of mooks, masterminds, and madmen.
Would you be interested in running a Cold Steel Warden's actual play?
Absolutely. We could do either a full session or a demo game, whatever you guys like.
Oh, we'll set that up. Jacob.
Thank you for inviting me. Had a lot of fun. I hope everyone keeps looking into the Superpowered Legends and Iconic Legends line. I have a lot more planned for it in the future.
Excellent. Aid, final shot.
Yep. Hello. Good to everybody. I believe my next villain out should be one called Freestyle, which is a street-level industrial espionage with the gravity skates. So that I believe that's next on the list, so keep an eye for that.
Jason?
Buy all of these other guys' brilliant books.
And to balance out some of the evil, please check out the latest release for Supers Revised Edition, which is the Bastion Saints, a free character pack for guys who need to run a quick game and just need some player character quick pre-gens. So my name is Walt. Thank you so much to the panel for coming out. And this has been the Banff Podcast.